So, after these months of reading The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines, talking about the philosophies, some of the underlying ideas, the approach to emptiness, the approach to the figure of the Bodhisattva, we came to retreat with this text of the heart of the teaching on the perfection of wisdom, known as the Heart Sutra. And the practices we did were a particular set of meditations, like the one we gave, really centered around the one I gave tonight, a version of, that begin with the way the Buddha really first lays out emptiness. As I said, in the Pali Canon, in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, middle length discourses 121, where he gives this metaphor that just as a space is empty of an object that's not in it, he says this meditation hall has no horses in it; it's empty of horses. So the core sense with emptiness is that you're meditating on the absence of something. And then he says, so in that way, meditating here in the forest is empty of the busyness and the stress of the city, right? The city is busy and noisy and dusty. Out here in the wilderness, it's quiet and peaceful. And so the meditation is a meditation on peace that's focused on the absence of stress. You find a stress that's not here, something that's busy, stressful, it's not here, and you feel a peacefulness being aware of that. And then the progression in the discourse goes into increasingly refined meditative states, each one characterized by the absence of a busyness or a stress that was in the previous level. And so the sequence that we worked with mostly was recognizing that where we were meditating was peaceful, just in and of itself, in the external. And then to come internally to the space of the body and mind and see or sense, really listen for is the sense, listen for the narrative layer in the mind. We're listening for words, right? All of the talking we do to ourselves, the stories we tell, the analyzing, the judging, the naming, the comparing, the fantasizing, all of that, the worrying, the planning, all of that words. And images, but words are really the stickiest ones. We would hear them and do the same thing. First, set them down. So very intentionally in the meditation, cutting off thought, just putting it down. As soon as you notice, it doesn't matter what it is, and just putting it down for now. And then noticing, really listening to the silence after the thought ends, but really noticing the peacefulness and the ease that's there when that narrative is not talking. So in the same way as you notice that the woods are quieter than the city, you notice that the quiet mind is quieter than the busy mind, than the distracted mind. And then with that as the doorway, there's any number of deeper layers that you can do. The main layer that we worked with from there was that layer of efforting and doing. How much am I doing to maintain this state? How much am I efforting here? And you can perceive that as a layer of stress, right? A layer of busyness, right? It's not always unpleasant, but stress here just means that which is less peaceful. So some layer of busyness. And to the extent that you can relax that, dropping into a space where you don't perceive that doing or that efforting, that's more peaceful. And so you work your way down as far as you can, land in any given moment. The mind fluctuates, of course. Sometimes it's easy to get quite spacious, sometimes not. And supporting that, just kind of as a basic support for samadhi, the gathered mind, we worked with the instructions we work with a lot in this group, the first tetrad of mindfulness of breathing. So mindfulness of the in and out breaths, mindfulness of long breaths, and we would really cultivate the long breath, and then let the breath shorten to natural short breaths. And then feeling the breath in the whole body, awareness of the whole body while breathing, and then calming and relaxing the body, relaxing impulse, really settling deeper into stillness. So this meditation is one way to do a meditation on emptiness. And if we take that meditation, we think about it in the light of the perfection of wisdom that we were reading. There's so much in the perfection of wisdom teachings that are about recognizing the amount of busyness or stress caused by cognition, caused by the naming of things, right? All of these places in the perfection of wisdom texts where the Buddha says to Bodhisattva Subhuti, Subhuti, did the Tathagata, the Buddha himself, achieve unsurpassed perfect enlightenment? And it's formulaic that he did. That's kind of the definite, that's why he's the Buddha. But Subhuti says no, because in perfect wisdom, I don't see any dharma here that corresponds to enlightenment or full enlightenment. There's no such thing as a bodhisattva, and there's no such thing as a Buddha, and there's no such thing as enlightenment. Not because it's not because there's not a real experience of liberation, but because the concepts of bodhisattva and Buddha and enlightenment and ignorance are concepts based in words and ideas, culture, structures, and all of those things. You can see that they're contextual, right? They come out of conditions, and so the progression of the teaching then is that it starts as a meditation on peacefulness, and then it's refined into a meditation that particularly recognizes the peacefulness of non-narrative cognition, of not being caught up in words, not being caught up in stories, into the distracted mind. And so then the meditation becomes a meditation on the absence of stressful layers in our cognitive framework that we let go of bit by bit, including all the way, perhaps ultimately, to the sense of the self, or even the idea that one could be liberated. I say, oh, I'm enlightened. That's a concept, right? And so the Heart Sutra starts off with this Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, meditating on one of the most common and useful lists in the Buddha's teaching, the aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, formations, consciousness, and seeing that they're all empty, right? And what he sees is that each of them is itself empty, like it's that can't really be grasped at. But beyond that, even the conceptual framework of the aggregates is already empty. All the words are empty, right? The framework is empty. And it goes through all these core teachings, the senses, the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, liberation itself, and all of those as concepts. The concepts themselves create some stress, some dukkha. And so you can see through them, you can set them down. And so the bodhisattva who does this lives in a way where the mind is unbound, unobstructed in the world. So this is the doctrinal teaching in the Heart Sutra. So we practice that meditation again and again. And that by itself, some deep beauty in the retreat, coming from a group of people gathering together, all practicing this meditation on deep silence and spaciousness. And it really creates a field in the space, a field of a kind of stillness and luminosity and brightness. to really do that together. And one of the things to say about retreat, for those who haven't been, is that there is a very particular magic to meditating together in person for a sustained period of time that is almost more than the sum of its parts. Like everyone, at any given moment, somebody could be having a very deep, still meditation, and somebody else could be totally distracted, having a crazy fantasy, arguing with themselves, having a doubt storm, you know, and you know your mind, all sorts of things happen. But the field that's created all together still has this effect of deepening everyone's experience. There's a kind of harmonic resonance of stillness that, you know, an energy that happens, and it helps everyone deepen, and really creates a palpable field in the space. So this is one of the beautiful things around practicing that everyone, especially practicing the same kind of instructions together, because it spins the same kind of energy in the space. So this is part of what the Heart Sutra is about and what the Perfection of Wisdom is about. Meditating, entering into deep stillness, seeing beyond concepts, finding a liberation that doesn't rely on the idea of liberation, that doesn't rely on any cognitive ideas at all. This is part of it. But the Heart Sutra doesn't just do that. It gives this particular, you know, deconstruction of concepts. But then it says that because of this, the sutra is a magic spell. The word is dharani. It's not just a discourse. It's actually a protection spell. And it has traditionally been used as a protection spell, like a concrete protection spell, a protection for travelers on a journey. It's used in ritual exorcisms of ghosts. It's used in a number of ritual circumstances that are quite magical and very, very animist. And the end of the text says, you know, therefore, understanding this deep absence of concept that liberates without the idea of liberating, and one lives with the mind unbound, the bodhisattva lives with mind unbound, taking refuge in the perfection of wisdom, prajna paramita, who is not just a teaching and a body of literature, but is also a goddess, that the text itself is a kind of spell, a dharani. And at the end it says, you should therefore know this great mantra, this unsurpassed mantra, equal to the unequaled, absolutely true, without anything false in it, and that it heals all suffering. And that's really that she, this goddess, perfect wisdom, heals. Wisdom heals in this understanding. And then it ends with this enigmatic mantra, gate, gate, paragate, parasangate bodhi swaha, which translates as an invocation about what is gone and gone all the way beyond. But one of the reasons that I wanted to learn the text in Sanskrit is that as one of the ancient Buddhist sacred languages, along with Pali and Tibetan and Chinese, but having a particularly close relationship to Pali and the earliest Buddhist languages, there's a resonance in the invocation of the text in Sanskrit that also helps stitch together the lineage of Buddhism through the 1,000 years that Buddhism had been lost in India and back to the earliest centuries of our spiritual ancestors developing these practices. And so we learned the text in Sanskrit, and we would chant it multiple times in a row. Before chanting it, we would do this short verse from the Theravada tradition. I learned it in the forest tradition. And it's a verse that is profoundly animist. It's a verse that invites the forest spirits, the spirits of place, wherever you are, to come and listen to the Dhamma, to listen to the teachings. And it invokes very specifically the spirits of mountains and rivers, of flowers and fields and home sites, and the forest. It invites the fairy musicians, the Gandhavas. It invites the sometimes wrathful spirits, the Yakshas, and invites the great dragons, the Nagas, who love the Dhamma, to come and listen. And so that also is, it's for protection, but it's also not just protection. It's not just, may we be protected by the spirits. They're not our servants, you know, to protect us. We can ask. But they're also friends, they're neighbors. They are, you know, they are other kinds of people who love the Dhamma, who love the teachings. And they gather around when people are doing good things, like practicing together. And so we would invoke these wild, you know, layers of the very real ecosystem that we don't always have access to. And then we would sing this magic spell. And so this whole mixture of, you know, meditating on this very, very spacious, still quality, and cultivating the deep listening that goes along with it. And then practicing, you know, inviting these sentient, benevolent forces to be present with us. Part of inviting the benevolent forces is also respectfully but firmly asking the non-benevolent forces to stay back and not come into the space. It's just as important to protect your space from, you know, beings who are more confused or who don't mean well, as it is to invite the ones that are faithful and mean well. And, you know, putting all of this together with some other practices, the breath work that we were doing and some movement practices, there's really the sense that, you know, working with material like this, working, you know, with material that's more than just the, you know, like mindfulness instructions, but very much these layers of spirit and energy and you know, the sentience of the ecosystem, that the retreat form, you know, can really be, you know, a container for some quite beautiful and palpable magic to happen. Using this term magic as a way to say, you know, a kind of work in the world that moves the us, but also just moves the material world, energetically, spiritually, through relationship, through ritual, through contact. You know, it was of course not lost on anyone there that we had just come through the election. And I think I mentioned it, you know, like maybe once at the very beginning, kind of just like, you know, it was a little bit like, ooh, wow, that was a lot. All right, we're here, you know. And then we just didn't hardly, I think, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, like hardly mentioned it the whole time. And just to really, for myself, say like, how extraordinary it is that there's this whole aspect of, you know, my life being engaged in the social and political realm, and our life as a collective and as a as many overlapping communities, and where, you know, I very much hold what we do in the political realm as being deeply important, having huge effects on the well-being of so many people. And being, you know, something that I want to engage in and really track and be present for the unfolding life of, the country and the communities and the governance, and try to take care of people. And just how important that is. And at the very same time, how important it is to have spaces where you can set that down for a little while. And not just for like an hour of, I have to just distract myself and watch some Netflix, forget about, like, there's all these articles in the newspaper, the last couple of weeks that are like, are you feeling just like total despair and craziness after the election? Try watching this sexy romp from the middle, that takes place in the Middle Ages. And I'm a little bit like, I don't know, like, sure. But to go on retreat is like to almost to say, like, it's not that I'm looking away. It's that we're going to stir up a different kind of force here to respond to the world. And that this, this is also a kind of magic, and a kind of engagement, in the political world. It's not verbal and it's not online. But that there's something really potent about creating spaces where folks who really care very deeply about their communities and how to engage, can come and pause and come to a very different, a very different just way of being in the face of everything that's happening. When the Dharma came to, to the West, in the Insight lineage, it's true in several of the lineages that came over. Maybe Zen a little bit less so, actually, given that it brought quite a bit of its ritual very centrally. But in the Insight tradition, the folks who brought over Vipassana and Metta, loving kindness practice, from Burma and Thailand, really focused, because the retreat form, I think, was so powerful. Insight practice, Vipassana practice, came over first as a retreat form. And so the emphasis was almost entirely just on silent retreat. It wasn't on engagement or social justice aspects, but also wasn't on, magic and animist, wild ecosystem prayer with, invisible dragons. They brought over a practice that was very psychological, very much about kind of emotional intelligence kind of work, and cultivating a particular kind of meditation based in mindfulness that was really good at getting at layers of neuroses and clinging pretty quickly, and doing beautiful work, on the like psychological and emotional maturing, and very beautiful spiritual work on, deep letting go and coming to an understanding of impermanence and suffering, selflessness. Really beautiful work bringing those aspects of the Dhamma over. But part of what they did in doing that was to help make it deeply relevant to a relatively secular, or at least very interfaith, American and European population, increasingly secular, was to really leave behind things that they decided, somewhat unilaterally, I might say, were cultural, and brought over the things that were, quote, universal, right? And those are in big fat scare quotes, because you can't separate those, and it denigrates the cultural ultimately, if that's what you're leaving behind, and saying, we brought over these valuable things that we think are going to be helpful here, and that's fun, just fundamentally a colonial maneuver there. And so in the following generations, their students and those their students' students, particularly now, but many of us, initially fell in love with the meditation practices. I did. But at the same time, the thing that brought me to the Dhamma wasn't just that. I wasn't a great meditator. I really liked silent retreat, introvert, et cetera, et cetera. But not very socially skilled. So I was like, oh, silence, like it's easier, less talking to people. That always made me uncomfortable. But the thing actually I always resonated with it was also like a kind of ritual that was there, that it was a very particular kind of prayer for me. And so many of us who fell in love with the Dhamma began to want more, to want it to be not just a psychological healing, but a deeply orienting spiritual life, a fully wrought spiritual life. And to do that, you have to have a view that really encompasses every part of your life. And many of us found that we were, not just psychological and emotional creatures, but actually had these layers to us that weren't accessed by those parts of practice. And so bringing back in the chanting, the ritual, the offerings, the connecting to a realm, or many, many realms, inviting contact with benevolent beings that we don't see visually. And just for me, I think it comes down to seeing what happens if I try to take seriously the entirety of what I find in the lineage. That doesn't mean I take everything literally, but I try to not decide what works for me and what doesn't based on my preferences and my cultural kind of background, which could just as easily be, trauma as, intelligence. So a lot of folks are doing this in a lot of different ways. And these teachings of the perfection of wisdom offer something quite extraordinary in relation to this, trying to revive a sense of the fullness of this Dhamma, this Dharma, because they're really the beginning of opening in meditation to a kind of state and a kind of insight where the thing we're finding in meditation is not just focus, and it's not just insight into a fundamental truth like impermanence or selflessness, but it's actually contact. It's contact with these beings, these bodhisattvas. It's contact with wisdom, not as an insight that I come to and liberate something in myself, but really as a force of being, a kind of sentience itself, right? This goddess of the perfection of wisdom, or the one who speaks the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, who is Kuan Yin here on the altar behind me. This big, our Kuan Yin here. And this changes the practice from being, mindfulness being a kind of psychological, emotional intelligence kind of discipline, into a more religious, a more devotional, a more mystical, a more relational kind of cultivation. I think it really changes the energy that we can bring in our practice. It changes the kinds of states that we access. And I think fundamentally it really changes what we're even doing in cultivating the path. But it's challenging to Western ego structure and to colonial power structures, and to, and to the common religion nowadays, which is scientific materialism, right? That believes wholeheartedly that only that which can be measured by machines and observed directly without particular training, except machine training, is real. But it discounts meditative experience as being real in any way other than personal, idiosyncratic fantasy-like dreams. And so it's very difficult to go against the stream of this religion, the materialist religion. And so the Dhamma, I think the Dhamma in all its forms resists this, but the perfection of wisdom really has a sword to cut through that in a kind of extraordinary way. And I get that when we study the text, but I can feel it in a very different way when we're on retreat practicing it, because we get to immerse in a very different kind of heart mind than we are in ordinary life. And you can say, I had a lot of focus and I was in a really interesting state. And that's true. And you could also say, we did an extraordinary magic and we were held and we were in the presence of beings that are beyond our usual comprehension. And I feel blessed by that contact. And I think those could be describing similar experiences, but they're actually they're different. And there's something I think quite powerful about opening to other ways of understanding what's happening as we're practicing and why practice works, and what it actually is that we realize when we have insight and when we open to the path. And let it rest for there. Thanks for listening.